Welcome to the last session of the day. This is Life as a Physicist. So just as a bit of an introduction to the session, throughout the past 2 weeks, we've had a lot of physics ideas. So physics ideas, either modern physics, 20th century stuff, or contemporary physics, 21st century, keynote speakers kind of stuff. And also your mentoring, so you're doing a lot of physics ideas, and we thought it would be really useful for you to see a bit of the other side of science, not just the ideas, but also just the human side of science. And so that's the intention of this Life as a Physicist session. What we do is we get two guinea pigs here, who are actual real live theoretical physicists, who have chosen this as a career. And they're living the life. Okay, so you can ask them questions about, well, how did you get to where you are? What does it feel like? What do you do in a day? All that kind of stuff, okay? You don't just sit around those couches, do you, all day? Okay, so what do they actually do? What does it mean to be a theoretical physicist? What kind of work are they doing? So on and so forth. So this is your opportunity to ask questions about just life as a physicist, more of the human side. So I'm really pleased that we have with us this camp, we have Roger Kovac and Sarah Croke. So these two physicists are our postdocs here at Perimeter, and they're both in the area of quantum information, quantum foundations kind of stuff. So they said no string theory questions. And besides, we don't want to focus on physics questions, physics concept kind of questions. We want to focus on just life as a physicist, the human side. So let's go. So fire some questions here.
Discuss with other physicists, just sit down in front of a blackboard and just kind of brainstorm ideas. What else is important? Of course, at the end of the day, you have to write papers. So when you've kind of had all your discussions and you've come up with your good idea, then you want to try to write that down in some, and you want to write that down so it's understandable to other scientists. So a lot of the time is, or some of the time is taken actually kind of writing papers to express those ideas in a way that other scientists can hopefully just pick up and sort of understand the ideas fairly quickly.
Yeah, I mean, it depends a lot on the day. So what do you do all day? All those things. I've spent whole days sitting in the bistro just chatting with colleagues, figuring out ideas. I've spent days in my office not talking to anybody. You finally get to the stage where you have to write things up, and I would say that's where the fun part ends. But it's obviously an important part of our job that what you've figured out is available to other people. What else do we do? We do things like this.
Give talks. I think that's another important
thing. Give talks
thing.
Is another
so
important
not only just writing papers, but of course you have to go to conferences and present your talk in front of audience. And that's a very important part because that's how you kind of get known to other researchers around the world. It's a lot more, I think it's a lot easier to get known if you give talks and travel rather than just expect people to happen to read your papers. Certainly when you're a young scientist, it's sort of, if you're a young, relatively unknown scientist, it's kind of more important to travel around and to get known. Maybe once you're already known, then people automatically start reading your paper.
And I think the converse is true. When you go to conferences, you learn about other people's papers that you might not have otherwise, because it's a different investment of time reading a paper compared to listening to someone talk about it or chatting with someone over coffee about their work. So I think you learn a lot from conferences and you get a bigger audience for your own work from conferences. Why not? should I go first?
Go for it.
You go first. So, you know, some people always wanted to do physics. For me, I kind of stumbled into it. I liked building things as a child and growing up. I thought I was going to be an engineer, but I didn't know what kind of engineer to do. So I went for physics, which is a bit more general, and you can still go back to, you know, engineering or something like that after a physics degree. But the more I went, the more interested I became in it. Certainly the later stages of my undergraduate course where we got to stuff that you've done already, so you guys are really lucky to be exposed to this stuff already, relativity, quantum mechanics. For me it was quantum mechanics that's, you know, this, as you've probably heard all week, this like really successful pinnacle of modern physics, and yet we don't really understand what it's telling us about the world yet, and so that to me was really compelling, and that's how I ended up continuing on.
Yeah, I mean, I was since as far as back as I can remember, really, I was always interested in kind of how the world works and questions like this, and so, and as I was growing up, I was reading more and more about it and just more and more inspired, and the natural thing to do is to, I mean, it's even more exciting when you can just be the first person to discover things somehow and just read about what other people have discovered. So, of course, you can do that in many other areas, but for me, physics was somehow the kind of more, the fundamental area that was more interesting somehow.
How did you start working
at the university?
They
asked me. So they have this kind of yearly application procedure for postdocs. So once a year they put an advert out and then you apply and then they invite you for an interview and or you give a presentation, you meet the kind of faculty there. It's a sort of informal interview in some way and then they offer you the job basically.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
Yes.
So does that mean you're looking, you still have to look for grants or?
At PI, no. So it depends a lot on your career stage. Typically, as an early career scientist, it's good to have your own fellowships. But something like a postdoc determiner is designed to be like a personal fellowship because you have a lot of freedom to work on whatever you want. And then as you get later in your career and you're a faculty member, it becomes important to apply for grants so you can have students and postdocs as well.
Yeah, so typically the higher faculty will apply for a grant, which includes a certain number of, for example, postdocs or students, and then they'll try and hire those. And once they're hired, the postdoc who's hired doesn't need to find the money. Typically, they already, it kind of comes with the money given by the professor.
What parameters
are
expected from you?
Good question. I mean, we get a lot of freedom to follow whatever we want, and it's balancing the freedom at Perimeter with the expectations of the wider community. So PI likes to give us a lot of freedom and the time to think deeply about things. We don't have to keep publishing papers all the time. They would like us to think deeply and come up with new ideas, but you have to balance that with I have to get a job when I leave here, so I need to publish papers. So what do they expect from us? They expect us to do research, they expect us to interact with other researchers, they do expect us to publish papers, and they would like them to be, you know,
good.
Be good.
Yeah, I mean, I can't add very much to that. I mean, I think they just want you to become a scientist, or to, if you, I mean, they want you to develop as a scientist and contribute to science ultimately.
Right.
That's a kind of nebulous thing. It depends what level you're at. So I think it's extremely competitive at the kind of faculty position level. So that's the kind of level where you want to get a permanent job. I think there aren't very many permanent jobs, and certainly not nearly as many. I mean, there's this kind of like triangle scheme where the number of jobs at each level kind of decreases. So I would say. So I think it's for good students. There are plenty of opportunities to do PhDs, and for postdocs, I think there are plenty of postdoc positions. And after you go up to that to get a kind of full time or to get a job that's permanent, I think there aren't actually a huge number. So it's really only, you have to be like really at the top level of your field really to expect to get a permanent job.
How often are you expected to publish papers?
It's a question of what I expect versus what the field expects.
there's no real answer
there's no
to
magic
that question.
Number.
I mean, if you, some people can come up with short papers, I don't know, several times per year. Some people, you know, if they can think for a few years and come up with a really good idea and publish a paper like that. I mean, there's no real expectation on the number of papers. You're not really judged exactly on the number of papers. I mean, of course, the number of papers is a measure of how successful you are as a researcher, but there's no kind of formal expectation. I mean, I would say probably most postdocs should be, I don't know, probably an average postdoc publishes between 3 and, I don't know, 6 papers per year, something like this.
Yeah. I would consider someone publishing 6 papers to be very productive, and 3 to be sort of, yeah.
How many citations per paper do you consider?
You guys know this stuff already. What do you need us for? There's a number of important things about publishing. There's volume and there's quality, and it's hard to evaluate quality of research. And so we have these imperfect measures, like how many times your work is cited and how many papers you've published. Citations depend a lot on the field. If you're working in something that's really fashionable right now, then there'll be a lot of citations. And if you're working in chronic foundations, then it's harder to get citations. And so when you're applying for jobs, I think people renormalize by field. If you get more than 100 citations, then that's a great paper. If you get,
yeah,
a handful, then you're already, people are paying attention to your work. It also depends on where in your career you are and how well people know you and how successful you are at going to conferences and advertising your work. There's no magic number. There's no good answer to that. And papers that turned out to be seminal later, sometimes got like 3 or 4 citations in the first decade after they were published. So there's no good answer.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
If you don't land a permanent job, what are your options?
I hope I don't have to consider that. I think the skills as a physicist you acquire as a physicist and learning physics are valued, so I'm told.
I think as a scientist you can almost go into any other job. Certainly if you do a PhD in physics and you decide now you don't want to be a physicist, then almost any job is open to you, except maybe like being a medical doctor or something where you have to really have a special training for. But in general, I don't think employers care whether you've got a PhD, and if I was an employer, I would look on that as a sign of high quality. Maybe if you had a PhD in physics, I'm biased, but I would say that, I mean, the kind of lessons you learn by doing research are actually applicable in many other areas of life, I think. I mean, you just apply them in a slightly different way to different types of problems, but just the way you do physics really is you have some problem you want to solve, and you can solve it in any way you want. You can think about it, you can read what other people have done, see how related they are, and you know, you talk to other people, all kinds of things like this. And these kind of solutions to this kind of way of problem solving, I think, is applicable in very many walks of life. So I don't think there's a, you shouldn't be worried about if you not being able to find a job if you have to change career at some point. I think it's very easy to find a job.
Maybe. I think the analytical skills are considered to be valuable that you learn as a physicist. So even after an undergraduate degree, you could go into many, many other things. After a PhD, again, I think finance is a big employer of physicists, for example, because of those analytical skills. You know, the basic equations governing the stock market are differential equations. So as a physicist, you learn a lot about that. So that's definitely a big employer, but there are other options. I guess the only other one I ever considered would be science writing, which is also something you can do with a scientific background. I should find out more, because this question always comes up. And we talk in the general about it, but it is true that this the skills you learn as a physicist are valued.
What's the coolest thing you'll be?
you know, it's a good question. I think the freedom to be creative. I think, you know, a lot of people have jobs where they do the same thing every day and someone else tells them what to do. I think it's a really nice thing to be able to go to work and decide, this is what I want to do today, this is what I want to learn today. For me, I've always just been really interested in learning more and more, and when you can actually contribute to that knowledge, that's really exciting.
Yeah, the coolest thing is to discover something that no one else knows at that point.
Yeah.
Maybe.
How many hours do you sleep at night?
It varies.
I have a 16-month-old baby, so it varies
not
a lot. Not enough.
Yeah, I mean, it varies a lot. Sometimes you feel more under pressure, you're really excited about a project, you want to just work on it. And other times, maybe you feel more relaxed, you just want to feel more normal, let's say.
I think it depends a lot on how you work as well. For me, I'm not someone who works very well on not very much sleep. So, you know, before I had the baby, I would sleep 8 hours a night. Now it's different, but that's unrelated to career. So yeah, I would work late, but I would still get my sleep. So it depends a lot on how you like to work, whether you can focus without sleep. Of course, there's also lots of caffeine.
Yes. there's like variations in like how much of a coffee junkie you are. That probably is highly correlated with how much sleep you have. Okay.
Have you ever gotten into like a sort of argument with one of your colleagues about your like what you're studying? Like you have one interpretation, they have another. Like a real actual argument, not just go, oh, I disagree with you.
What do you mean by an actual argument? I've never punched someone. Yeah, I mean, I've had kind of, let's say, heated email discussions about kind of about whether what I did was correct. I mean, people do criticise your work sometimes. Hopefully, it's because they didn't understand it, and you have to convince them. But of course, I mean, it can happen. Of course, that people are wrong. I mean, so yeah. I mean, you do have discussions, and it's not always like everyone agrees with everything. Science, as you maybe expect, you might expect to, but
that's part of the process. I mean, that's what science is about, is being able to stand up to criticism. I think whether you have heated arguments or not is also very field dependent. I think our field is quite friendly, so there's a lot of discussion, but not necessarily arguments. I've found myself in the position of pointing out to colleagues that they're both making the same argument. So I think there's a lot of discussion. Physics is about
Yeah, you shouldn't think of it like a negative thing if someone tries to criticize your work, because ultimately it should make your work stronger.
Right, because it might be something you haven't thought of.
Yeah, it might be something you haven't thought of. And by working out why their criticism is wrong, if it is wrong, then you probably learn something. You probably understand better what you're doing.
How do you often get research topics?
How do you what?
Research topics. Like,
how do you choose them?
Yeah, like you, suddenly like something flashing your mind, and get it, or like people assign a certain topic to you.
You know, I'm still figuring this out. I think you've touched on, like, it's a really important skill for a physicist. I think typically people think, oh, you have to be really good at maths to be a physicist, and you do. But you have to be somewhat good, but there are other skills that are just as important, and I think picking problems is one of the most important skills that you're not maybe formally taught how to do. So the answer for me is I'm still figuring it out. A lot of my work has been collaborative, and so I find that in discussing with somebody else, we come up with an interesting problem. But it's also important to be able to direct your own research, and how do you do that? I guess, you know, you pick something that you find interesting and you read up on it and you try to figure out if there's any interesting questions that you could look at.
Yeah, I mean, when you're a young researcher, typically, like when you start your PhD, for example, you'll have an advisor, and probably for the first project you do, he'll essentially tell you the project. And maybe for the first few projects you do, he'll tell you the project, and you go away and you think about it, the more and more projects you've done, you become kind of very familiar with this research area, you become really an expert in it. And then you can start seeing for yourself where the kind of gaps are, where there are kind of new directions to go in. And then you can just think, if there's something you don't understand, then either someone else already understands it, and if they don't, then there's a project in principle. Of course, you don't want to just always investigate the first random thing that you don't understand. So it's of course important to kind of balance that with how important you think this will be for other research. And to do that, it's not that easy, but you can kind of look at suppose you solve that problem, you can say, what other problems would I be able to solve? Or how will that shed light on this other problem that some other guys are working on? And so on. And another thing is that fields often have like kind of open problems that are reasonably well known. Of course, they're typically open problems because
they're really hard.
Because they're hard and people have thought about them and they don't know how to solve them. But of course, but you don't have to solve maybe the open problem, but you can solve some kind of related problems. And you know, at least by doing that, if you can do that, then people will be very interested in what you're doing.
So I guess like going into university, you had some idea of what it was to be a physicist, and like how accurate was that?
I had no idea.
Yeah, I don't think I had very much.
I hadn't thought about it, to be honest. As I said, I was going to do engineering. I didn't know any physics researchers, I don't think. I think there are different types of people. Some people are very focused and they know what they want to do and they have an idea in their head of how it is. For me, I just ended up in physics, and I didn't have any preconceived notions of what a physicist is like. If I had, I don't know how that would have affected my choice. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, when I went to university, I didn't really know what really the life of a physicist was like. I don't remember whether I had any preconceptions of that. Of course, I knew I was going to study physics, and I knew that I enjoyed studying physics and learning about physics, but I think actually the way, like when you come out of school, I think typically you just have no idea about this, unless you've really made a special effort to acquire that knowledge.
Like this?
Yeah. So you guys are at a big advantage.
Yep.
How much of your work is collaborative?
That varies a lot, depending on the person. For me, quite a lot. Yeah, I enjoy discussing with other people. Some people prefer to work alone, and both are important. And certainly for building a career, it's important to be able to show that you can work alone and set research problems yourself. Because eventually you're going to want to set problems for your students and your postdocs and so on. So for me right now, most of my work is collaborative, but it varies a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know, if you look at, for example, there's this archive which lists the papers that, it's like the daily list of which papers came out that day. And I guess the majority of papers are have more than one author.
Yeah,
the vast,
there's very
the
few
vast majority. So I'd say most people are working not purely by themselves, I mean, most of the time. There are some people that really just like to work on their own, and then you can do that. I personally think that it's better to have at least one other author, just for, I mean, there are many reasons. First of all, it's it kind of speeds up your work, because typically if there's something I don't know, but maybe my co-author does know it, and you can just work a lot faster. If you have the combined knowledge of two people working on a problem, that's much faster. Secondly, if you write the paper, if there are two people who are kind of proofreading it, it's likely to be easier to read in general, because if I write a paper, I have kind of my notion of what people already understand, but my co-author has some other notion of what people already understand, and if we both think it's understandable for other people, then it's probably more understandable than for just one of us has written it. So yeah, I would say most research nowadays is done in collaboration.
So what's the usual size of a collaborative research group? And is there kind of like a conventional structure, like a mathematician, someone who focus on like conceptual ideas or
Yeah, normally it's not, I mean, a typical research problem is not kind of compartmentalizable enough to do that. I mean, in an ideal world, you'd be able to say, you know, we have this problem, and if you guys do this tough mathematical part, we'll do the conceptual part, and then we'll bring it all together at the end. But I think typically if you know that much about the problem, it's already kind of solved in some sense. So the kind of problems that we're really working on, you don't really know how to solve them initially. And so it's, you typically can't put such structure into this, I would say.
And as for the size of a collaboration, I think it depends a lot on the institution as well, because some places, like you talked about, a professor having a grant for students and postdocs, then in some sense a lot of people work on that problem together.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're an independent researcher, you might work with one or two other postdocs at the same level. Yeah, it varies a lot from institution to group.
What's your hair does
nothing? I have no idea.
I actually don't know. Question is, what is our Erdos number?
Which is...
So it means, like, how many... So if I collaborate with someone... So suppose I collaborate with someone, and they collaborated with Erdos, then my Erdos number is probably two.
Is it two
or one? Then it's two, okay.
Is it two? Yeah.
But, so I don't know, I mean, yeah, I don't know how long the chain is until if one of my collaborators collaborated with Erdos. So.
you had a question?
Yes. What do you find is the most difficult part of
Let me think about that. Do you remember? There are lots of challenges. I think, for me, the most difficult part is there not being enough hours in the day. Definitely. There's just too much to do. And because there is this competition for permanent jobs, you always feel like there's someone who can devote more time to it than I can. That's the biggest problem.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, time management is just a very big problem. There's so many interesting open research problems. I mean, even if you say you're only going to work these hours per day or something, then you still have to decide what to work on and how to juggle, you know, keeping this collaborator up to speed with your project you're supposed to work on with them, or writing this other paper with some other guy or something. Reading some papers to improve your knowledge of a certain area. I mean, there's so much that you want to do, and actually that the older I get, the like higher my list of things I want to do gets.
Yeah, yeah.
And
do you think at some point that you assimilate so much knowledge about the field that you're kind of at a very good level to just continue with the search? But it never happens. You always want to learn more, you always need to keep current, and there just aren't enough hours in the day.
Do you find
that
you have a family?
Yes. yes, it means my time is much more restricted. But I would say, and everybody that I know who's had kids would say, it makes you much more focused. So yes, I didn't have enough hours in the day before, but I also wasn't using them as efficiently as I am now. I know I can work from 8:30 till 5, and then I have to go and collect the monster for daycare. And, you know, I have maybe an hour or two in the evening to work. But if I don't get it done in that time, I don't have another opportunity. Whereas before, I would very often be like, oh, well, I can do that later. You know, I'll have a look at that when I go home because I don't have time right now. There's something else I want to do. Now I know I have to get this done, and so I procrastinate a lot less. and I just use my time more efficiently, I think. So it's doable. It's definitely doable.
What's the typical retirement age of theoretical physicists?
I think
they stop getting paid at some point, but they still typically. I mean, your university will not pay you when you're older than the official retirement age, I guess. But
which is important because there's younger people waiting for jobs, right? So
yeah, exactly.
It is important that they stop getting paid at some point.
But of course, once you're retired and you're receiving your pension, no one can stop you still doing research. A lot of physicists enjoy it enough to do that as long as they can.
I think, you know, it's very much a vocation, or at least it seems to be from all the physicists I know. It's something that people devote their lives to, and I'm not saying that that's necessarily the only way to approach it, but it's certainly... It certainly can be all-consuming, and so people find by the time they get to retirement age, they still love it so much that they keep working.
Yeah. I mean, in order to devote your career even to physics, you have to really love it. And if you really love it, then you just want to keep going to the end, I guess.
I guess.
We'll see what happens to me when I get there, if I make it. Yeah.
Do you find it stressful being a physicist?
It can be.
Sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, it's like kind of stressful in some ways. And I mean, of course, if you look at it from the outside, it looks very unstressful in the sense that you can show up at, you know, no one checks what time you get to work in the morning, when you leave, all this kind of stuff. But the pressure is not really kind of from your boss, but it's sort of...
It's kind of self-imposed.
Yeah, it's the pressure to get a job at the end of the day. So you kind of realize how competitive it is being a physicist, and you have to try and compete with others, because when that precious job comes available on the market, you want to be like a candidate with a very good chance. So that is typically what drives you, I guess, to work and try and produce as much as you can.
I don't want to.
So it can be a bit stressful when you're, I guess, coming to the end of, for example, when you're applying for jobs as well. I mean, that is also a very time-consuming process. You can, I mean, that can be kind of stressful. You also typically have to move a very long way because... I mean, as you can probably tell, I'm not from Canada, so... and typically a researcher has to actually do a lot of... Typically has to do a postdoc in another country. I mean, it's not absolutely essential to do that, but...
It's common. It's very common.
That's very common, and even if you don't go to another country, you have to move city, and while you're a postdoc, you have to do this every two or three years. But, so, I think this is part of the stress as well.
Which is why I say that people love it. That's why they do it. I think there are definitely stresses and pressures to the job, but there are advantages that, you know, the pressure is self-imposed. So there's a lot of freedom, but with that comes a lot of, like, worry, am I doing the right thing? Am I spending enough time on it? Am I using my time effectively? You know, do other people think my research is good? So there's a lot of internal dialogue and there's stresses in that sense. But it's also a very creative job, and there's definitely a lot of plus sides to balance the stress. But it's certainly true that you generally move around a lot, and that can add stress. Yeah. But it's also, traveling is a plus as well, right? Some people like to travel. It's nice to live in different cities, and you get to travel a lot for conferences as well, which is fun.
How do you balance your life with physics?
With difficulty. we mentioned that it can become all consuming. I think the trick is to figure out for yourself how much you're willing to commit to a career and how much other things in your life are important. So for me, it was important to have a family, and I recognize that that means I have less time to devote to physics, and I'm okay with that. So there's definitely a lot of time management. I think, other people won't guard your personal time for you. You have to decide what you want out of life and somehow protect the time that you want for yourself, which is hard.
Yes, but I wouldn't recommend, for example, trying to work the whole time. I mean, maybe some people can do this, but I think it's also important for a good researcher just to give your mind some time to relax and to, do some sports or
right. Something.
So I think even if you really wanted to, that probably wouldn't be the best strategy to just every time, all the moment that I'm awake, I'm going to be thinking about physics, for example. But of course, it is a problem that all researchers face as to how to balance their life. And I guess because of the sort of pressures, most of them probably balance it a bit too much towards physics, I guess.
I think there was a question at the back.
Do you get paid well?
Well enough. I mean, yeah, it depends what you mean by well, of course. If your interest in life is money, then don't become a physicist. But that's not to say we're paid badly. But it's just to say that
if your main motivation is to make money and you're smart enough to get a PhD in physics, then you can make a lot more money elsewhere. Let's put it that way. If that's your main motivation, if you enjoy what you're doing, you can certainly make a good living. It's not super well paid, but it's certainly, we're not on the poverty line by a long shot.
I mean, it varies a lot by country actually as well. I think some countries are more respecting in terms of salary in science than others.
An institute perimeter pays.
Yeah, but I mean, for example, in Canada, and at least a perimeter, yeah, the salary is one of the highest for a postdoc.
So I've probably had a lot of these moments, but which idea in physics really blew your mind?
Okay, so I would say the most surprising thing about physics to me is it's the violation of Bell inequalities. So I don't know if you know anything about that. Probably not, and I probably shouldn't spend too much time explaining it now. But it's basically that
So, did they touch on this at all in the lectures?
We didn't do Bell's inequality.
Okay.
But you can look it up in the book. What is
it called?
Bell's inequality.
You want to explain a little bit? Bell's inequalities are, they bring out a non-local feature of quantum mechanics. So you probably learned that in quantum mechanics, measurement outcomes are probabilistic. We don't totally understand what that's telling us about the world, and one approach is to try to come up with a hidden variable theory. So there's actually something about the world that we don't have access to that determines how these measurement outcomes, which measurement outcomes occur. Bell's theorem says you have these entangled states, so if I make a measurement over here and a measurement over here, it sets limits on those local, those hidden variable theories, and says that the hidden variables have to be non-local. So ones over here have to influence ones over here. Is that fair?
Yeah, so maybe I can say in a slightly different way. Imagine I have a game, right? There are two parties trying to play a game, and those parties are not allowed to communicate after the game starts, and basically I'm going to ask them questions and check what kind of answers they give. Okay, and now what I can do in classical physics is I can work out their best possible strategy for that game, and I can calculate the probability that they can win that game. And then it turns out that within quantum physics they can win that game with a higher probability, and what it looks like from the outside is as if these two players are actually telepathic. So if you're a classical physicist, the only way to explain how they can do so well, how they can win this game so well, is if you believe in some kind of telepathic link between them. But actually that's kind of the power, that actual is given by the power of quantum mechanics, is why they can actually do that.
What does it feel like to never really know whether you're right or wrong?
I mean, physics is very empirical. You know, actually, it's all about proving that you are right.
Yes.
Because it's a very mathematical-based science, you really work through proofs and you know whether it's... You follow mathematical logic and you really know whether it's right or wrong. Whether you know whether it's really describing reality or not, maybe that's what you're asking.
Well, if you're wrong, it's better. Because that means something's
more
interesting.
More interesting.
So what I would say, like what we have is we have a bunch of theories and we typically work with these theories. So as a theoretical physicist, what you do is you prove some property of the theory you're working in. So that's really a very mathematical statement, and you know it's right. And what the only thing that can sort of be, assuming you didn't make a mistake.
Based on certain assumptions that you made at the start.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So it's kind of a theorem. It says, assuming this, and this, it follows something else. And you mathematically prove that relationship. And now you can ask, well, what if my world doesn't fit those assumptions, basically? And of course, you can never really know that. And of course, we work with the assumptions that we think fit the world as best we know it. And if one day we're shown to be wrong, then I would say that's more exciting in some way, because it shows that there's more to physics than we thought. Like, our understanding of physics at the time when we proved these things was inadequate. And learning that the world works differently to the way you thought it did is kind of the interesting part of physics in some way.
Yeah. What has been your most discouraging moment in physics? How did you pick yourself up from?
Wow, you've been to like interview questions in school or something.
You want to answer
this? No.
Okay. Most discouraging moment. Okay, maybe not moment, if I can make it a little broader. I guess for me the hardest time was the transition from being a student to being an independent researcher. Because as we mentioned, as a student, often your problems are given to you by someone else. And for me, at the start of my PhD, I was given a problem, and I developed it. Like, it turned into something totally different. So I did feel that it was something I brought to it. But as an independent researcher, I had to come up with my own problems to work on. And you have to have a lot of self-confidence that what you're doing is interesting to other people and is important. Making that transition to being able to justify what I wanted, what I was working on, was difficult for me. And how I picked myself up from that was collaborating with other people. Just finding people that I'm comfortable working with and chatting through ideas with them and learning from their ideas. I think physics is a lot more social than I would have expected.
Okay, so I would say that maybe the time I was most discouraged was actually probably when I, like, towards the beginning of my PhD, actually, because you come out of this university system, and I would say the way that the university systems work is typically completely different to how research works. So first of all, it's a bit of a shock what happens, I mean, a little bit. And also, you're surrounded by all these people who just know so much more than you, and you feel you're kind of so stupid in comparison, and that you're going to take so long to work on this problem. Look, why don't we just give it to this guy sitting next to me, who'll solve it in 5 minutes flat, and then you have to say to yourself, well, so you look at, and you just say, you know, is it really worth what I'm doing when this guy next to me is really so much faster, and he knows so much more, and he can, but, so how do you build yourself out of that? It's just by perseverance, I guess. So if you, I mean, you just have to stick with it, and you realize that although there are tough times, and of course, when you're the new guy, I think it's going to be the same wherever you go, right? When you're the new guy, everyone else is going to know more than you, and you have to just want to know enough, and you just keep at it, and eventually, at least in the area you're interested in, you start to know more than other people, and you start to see that when you give talks, people really don't know everything that you're telling them already, and they seem interested in what you're doing, and then you kind of get a reward back from all that kind of hard time you spent on the bottom rung feeling stupid.
Yeah, I think a common mistake early in your career as a student is to assume when you're giving talks that your audience already knows
yes.
everything you're talking about. So it's a nice surprise when they don't.
What are some of your idols and chins? Inspirations?
So I can tell you a book I read, which was very inspirational to me, which was by Roger Penrose. It's called The Emperor's New Mind. And I read this book when I was, I think, just at the end of my high school. And it kind of gives a very, it gives a kind of survey of a lot of areas of physics in a very inspiring way, and it shows connections between them and fun problems here. And I personally found that a very big source of inspiration when I was at that stage.
Role models. I don't think I've ever consciously considered anyone a role model. The things that inspired me were certainly learning first about quantum mechanics, as I mentioned, and it's more the content, the subject matter, I guess, than the people who were involved. I would like to be able to say that such people are really inspiring to me, but I think you have to find your inspiration.
I mean, sometimes you go to a really, really good talk and you just come
right.
away and you
and
feel
you come
like
away
that was,
totally revitalized.
That was,
yeah. Yeah, and that's why, I think.
Discrimination or racism in science?
I think we would like to think that it doesn't, because we want to think that science is very merit-based. But it's... I have to say. I think it probably happens more than we would like, and it's known that people tend to think of people who are like them more often. So if there's a lot of white men organizing a conference, they're more likely to think of white men as invited speakers. I mean, this is a real problem. And so it's important when you're organizing conferences, for example, to consider minority candidates and women candidates, and not choose them because they're minority or women, but at least, you know, think outside the box and think of those people, and then consider whether they're the people you want to talk at your conference or not. Whereas they're easily overlooked, and in that sense, it's a kind of a subtle discrimination. I hope there isn't any conscious discrimination anymore.
Yes, there's certainly none that I'm aware of. Of course, we're all very aware that physics is kind of has a very restricted set of groups that typically dominates it, and there are, I mean, no one really properly understands exactly why that is, but for example, there's not that many women in physics, and so it's, yeah, I mean, racially there's a huge disparity in professors in physics institutions, and it's not entirely clear what has caused that. Of course, in some sense it's historical, so, but I haven't seen any instance of obvious blatant racism or sexism or anything like this.
Yeah, so my answer as well would be I haven't seen any obvious instances, but that's not to say we shouldn't be vigilant and that they don't happen. I think awareness is important, that people know that there is this disparity, and try to, you know, for things like hiring and organizing conferences, try to consider candidates that are outside their own social sphere. But which is also related to sort of the question of connections and things like that. It's not just discrimination and racism, but...
Yeah, I mean, some of it is about role models as well, I guess. I mean, if you come from one of these backgrounds and you see this community which has none of your people who are like that, then you maybe don't aspire to that kind of career. I mean, that's a possible reinforcement mechanism for these kind of low these minorities, for example. But,
yeah.
Do you have some advice that you wish someone had given you before?
So, one thing I could potentially highlight is that at university, I mean, in hindsight, I wish I had studied more mathematics courses.
Me too.
And I'm not sure if anyone could have really given me advice in hindsight which would have led me to do that, but given my position now, I mean, there are some certain areas of mathematics that would have been much, I think it would be much more convenient if I'd learned them at university. So I'd say to anyone here who wants to be a theoretical physicist, do all the most mathematical options that are available to you at university, because those are typically the ones that will be most useful to you as a theoretical physicist.
I think I would have worked much harder in university. Not that I didn't work hard, but given these limitations with time that we talked about, I think I would have used the time to learn all the things I wish I knew now. Like lots of maths. Yeah.
Yeah. You spoke about traveling as a young physicist to present your papers. Have you ever gone to a different country to present your own papers?
Yes. I mean, that's actually very typical. It's typical that you'll go to different countries to do that, actually. So, for instance, in our field, every year there's this big conference that people really want to try to present their papers in. Once a year, there's this big conference, and it moves location every year. So, for example, this year it's actually in Montreal, but last year it was in Singapore. The year before it was in Switzerland. So, I mean, you typically, the top conferences, I mean, of course, when you're like at the forefront of physics, there's only a handful of people around the world that really are also interested and kind of following exactly what you're doing. And so typically you're going to have to go outside your country. I mean, Canada's, of course, a very big country, but even so, you'll want to go outside of that country to give talks and presentations. So I think international travel is basically essential as a physicist.
I think probably most fields have, you know, one international conference that's sort of the conference for that field. And that moves around the same as with our field. So it's essential.
Yeah, I think it's essential.
Yep.
Is pros and cons a problem in physics?
I mean, there are cases of it. They're not, I don't think they're a problem in the sense that they're, and they're not hindering science. They,
right.
They're typically, I mean, of course, the ones that get noticed, they're not a problem. I don't know how many get unnoticed, but I mean, I don't think it's rife. I mean, there are cases of it, and I don't think it's kind of holding back the community in some way.
Yeah, I think it's probably small enough incidents that it's not really a big issue. Yeah.
Is there one country or another that you visited because of physics?
Sorry?
Is there one country that you visited more than others because of physics?
Canada?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I think that typically there will be, depending on which field you go. So
yeah.
Certain fields have certain big places in the world, which for whatever reason have kind of decided that they're going to push that field with respect to others. Of course, it varies a lot. I mean, some fields, like for example, I don't know, astrophysics. Maybe there's almost all universities will have an astrophysics department. And you maybe don't have to be so restricted about where you go. But for example, in our field, there's an extremely big group in Singapore. So probably I've been to Singapore much more than I would have done otherwise if I'd studied some other subject. And also Canada, actually. There's a very big quantum information kind of community in Canada. But in another field, like there's just nothing in Singapore, for example. So through physics, you just wouldn't end up going there. So I think the field you study does affect where you need to travel to, or where you are more likely to travel to.
Yeah.
Was that the question? Yeah.
Kind of related, but they asked, would you say that physics, and that because of your work, you probably travel more than if you had another job? Like, it's really common to like travel around the world with your physics?
Yeah, I think it's a really important part of your job, and even more important than I realized now that I have a kid, it's really hard for me to travel, and I sort of, that's the restriction I notice in my work more than the time restriction, because the things that Roger mentioned earlier, it's really only by going places and talking to people that people take notice of your work, because there's so many papers out there, it's hard to keep on top of everything, and so travel is definitely essential. And compared to another job, I mean, it's probably the same across academia.
I
don't know about humanities, but probably most of science, you would need to travel for your job. And
yeah, and probably compared to, I don't know what you consider a normal job, but I mean, I mean, if you're a teacher, then I'm sure you don't really travel that much. I mean, if I'm a high school teacher, yeah, I mean, I can go on holiday, right? but of course, if you're a businessman, then depending on what your business is, you may have to travel. But I mean, I would say I travel maybe three times a year.
I think you want to go to at least one international and one national conference every year. And then you might want to visit research groups where you have collaborators, and so that's another travel visit. So yeah, I think, you know, at least three trips a year is normal. Maybe even more. And if you're on the job market, even more. You need to be able to go to different institutions and visit. So, yeah.
What are your views on experimental physics?
Sorry?
Experimental physics?
No, I didn't hear the first part of it.
What are your views?
I think it's great. So I'm a theoretical physicist in name, but I've been involved in experiments as well. For my PhD, I did both the theory and the experiment of what I worked on. So, you know, I think it's definitely an invaluable part of physics, and we feed off each other. It's different, very different skills, I think. An experimental physicist we both need to be persistent, but I always think I wouldn't have the patience to be an experimental physicist full-time, because you're so dependent on external factors, your equipment not working, or little niggly things. I think it's a really good experience for a theoretical physicist to go into a lab and see what they do with, because we're both quantum information. We say, okay, so you have a two-level system, and then you interact it with another one, and then you make this big, giant collective measurement, and then if you think about what that actually involves in the lab, it's months of work. So I think it's a really important interaction.
Yes, I mean, you cannot have physics without experimental physics.
It's just maths. Without experiments, we're just doing maths.
I mean, you really want to, you have to, I mean, physics ultimately is about coming up with the theory of the world, and what the world means has to be checked by experiment. So you want, I mean, the typical theory kind of experiment interplay would be that you come up with a theory and then you go and test it in the lab and then you see that it's not quite right and then you refine your theory and so on. So that really physics is about this interplay. And I mean, I think, of course, both parts are completely essential to the whole project.
Because you travel around so much, have you ever had a language barrier when you communicate?
Well, fortunately, the language of physics is English. And so wherever you go to a conference, the conference is always given in English. Of course, sometimes you're sitting down at dinner in some country where you don't speak the language and all the people around you speak the other language, and then it's a bit awkward. But certainly not from any kind of scientific point of view. I mean, yeah. So it's like going on holiday with your friends. You take a bunch of people with you who you know you can talk to, and then it doesn't matter about them. You can kind of point at things on the menu.
That's one question. Yeah.
Are there any collaborations among experimental and theoretical physicists?
Yep, I'm part of one.
Yeah,
I think there's probably the whole range. There are theoretical physicists that never talk to experimentalists. I guess most experimentalists have to talk to theorists at some point.
A lot of experimental groups actually employ a theorist or someone who's at least also strong in theory. Because, whenever you do an experiment, you need a theorist to sort of calculate what you're doing. But the kind of more hardcore theorists maybe try to stay away from.
I guess some areas of physics don't have experiments. You know, I mean, we.
Yeah, if you're like a cosmologist.
Right.
Or something.
But there's observation.
Yeah, then you go.
So yeah, there's.
You can't go and do an experiment to make a new Big Bang, but you can look out there and try and see what happens.
What kind of advice would you give to like a high school student who likes physics but doesn't know what they want to do with it as a career?
You mean which area they want to go into? Or?
How much do you like it? So the simple answer, my advice would be, if you like it enough, then follow what you like and study it in college. You don't necessarily have to do a PhD and become a physicist. You still have lots of options after a physics undergraduate. So if that's what you like, that's what you're going to be successful at. You know, there's no point, I think, personally, there's no point in trying to push yourself to do something that you're not that interested in, because you just won't be as successful if you don't have the passion.
Yeah, I would say typically your degree doesn't really impact your job prospects afterwards. So if you just do an undergraduate degree and you want, most employers, except for things like medicine, as I said before, like they don't really care what you got your degree in. If you get a, they care about what grade you got maybe, but typically they'll just care that you have a degree. For virtually all jobs you get out of the university after you've done your undergraduate. So I would say don't worry too much. Just do the thing you enjoy most. And if you stop enjoying it at some point, then you can say, right, I'm just going to go and get another job.
I think an undergraduate degree gives you that opportunity to see how much you like it, if you like it enough to stick with it, without actually committing to being a physicist.
So how much, what role does the computer play in the theoretical physics? I mean, do you program a lot? Do you use, maps?
It varies a lot depending on the problem you're looking at. So I don't that much at the moment, but I don't use computers that much in my research, but it is quite common to do numerical work. I think we're all pretty fluent in Mathematica.
Of course there are branches of physics that are just purely like computational physics, where they've they sort of, I mean, I guess a lot of problems in physics, I mean, most problems in physics are just too complicated to like find the analytical solution. And so one kind of common approach, and this has sort of come out as this area of computational physics, is just to really, you know, just get the computer to crunch the numbers, and then you're programming probably the whole time and seeing what comes out and seeing whether your program's unstable or what's happening, and then you go here and so on. So it really would vary a lot. I mean, for a personal level, I would say I use computers to try to help me check whether what I'm doing is likely to be correct. So if I'm trying to prove something, maybe I come up with some conjecture about what I think is true. And a very good way is to simulate it. So you just try thousands of examples. Maybe if you find a counterexample, then you know you don't have to bother trying to prove your conjecture. And if you try enough examples and you don't find a counterexample, then maybe it's worth spending the time trying to prove it. So I kind of use it in that way mainly in my work, I would say.
Yeah, so if you're clever about it, I think computers can save you a lot of time in that sense. And it's also complementary, and you know, if you're trying to figure out some properties of some equation, you can try and do it some work analytically, and you can also use some software to plot it and see what the solution looks like. You know, it's complementary in the sense that you see something about it, but you don't get the intuition about the general solution, which you can get analytically. So there's an interplay. I think computers are useful, but, and probably even if you're not in the super computational field, people use it in some sense. Yeah. Yes?
During your undergraduate degree, how important do you think it is to sort of take a lot of like proof-based pure math courses? Like, how often do you really use that afterwards? Like, do you ever run into like real analysis again, or like proving that sort of thing, or is it more if you're going into mathematics that you're going to want to take courses?
So I think in most, I don't know, yeah. I mean, in the kind of physics we do, you ought to know how to really prove something, like rigorous mathematical proof. So I mean, that is really, in a sense, what a theoretical physicist is doing in a lot of cases, right? You just assume the theory is correct, like if you're a bunch of assumptions, and then you really want to prove that from those assumptions, something else follows. You can do something with this probability and something like that. So I think it is very, I would say it's necessary to know all, like to be able to know how to do a rigorous proof, to be a theoretical physicist, at least in the area that we.
I guess the parts of maths that I wish I had learned more are the more conceptual things, group theory, algebra, geometry stuff, you know, just more kind of conceptual than actual rigorous proofs. Proof is one aspect, and then there's other parts of mathematics that are certainly useful. Yeah.
How do you choose a university?
How do you choose a university for an undergraduate?
How do you choose a university for an undergraduate degree, and how does the university choose you, and maybe some comments on funding, how you pay for your education,
Sure.
The options that are out there.
Yeah, so I can't speak for how it works in Canada, unfortunately, but so in England, what you do is you pick a university. Essentially, you apply to several universities typically, and you kind of make a list. And probably what a lot of people do is they apply to some very good universities and some not quite so good, so that if they miss one of their grades, they still have a backup option. And then depending on where you apply, you maybe have to go there. Maybe they just write you an offer straight away. Where you go, I guess you typically choose based on prestige. So there's usually a kind of hierarchy that's vaguely established, and certainly employers kind of have a hierarchy in their mind of which universities are better than others, and you want to aim as high as you can.
I think it's true that there is a hierarchy of prestige universities, and I've avoided them throughout my career because I think there's a different environment in different sorts of institutions. I went to the local university where I grew up to do my undergraduate, and I think that it's what you make of it. You know, I think if you study hard and you do well, then you're going to do okay. It's important not to go to a really bad university, but in terms of being at the best or one that's also quite good, for me, the difference in environment was enough that I think I thrive more in the less prestigious environment. Excuse me. And I did that for my undergraduate and also my graduate degree. And, you know, I did fine.
Yeah, I mean, as a physicist, I think it doesn't matter that much, actually. I think this kind of supposed hierarchy is more for, it's more what employers kind of use to subtly differentiate you at some point, because they typically have a bunch of people who have all got degrees and they don't know how to differentiate you. Whereas as a scientist, like once you've done a PhD, for example, and you've got some publications, then it's stopped, then that kind of consideration just is completely irrelevant.
I would visit places you're interested in applying to and see what it feels like to you, if you like the campus, if you like the people you meet there.
Yeah, and then for funding, I mean, that I think it's too country specific to say it's
yeah,
law school. I don't know how it works in Canada.
In Ireland, free. Third level education is free, so there was no funding issues.
You can start a new research area if you come up with
a
very good idea, but of course it's hard to do that, so a lot of people are just following kind of pre-established paths in physics, and of course it's good to try and mix those two kind of approaches.
So to an extent you have to build on what's come before you, but I think the goal for all of us is to do something really original.
Recently, this thing like Venus from Krypton.
Sorry?
The coolest from Krypton is the coolest.
So
we came up with a new uncertainty principle. That's, I mean, what should I say more about it? I mean, what was it? I mean, an uncertainty principle is really like basically a mathematical theorem. So you have some very well defined mathematical quantities, and you want to prove that some relation holds for them. And the interesting part about it is that it relates so closely to the fundamentals of physics or quantum physics ultimately. So it's about how well you can really simultaneously predict the outcomes of different measurements on a single system. So yeah, I mean that's. My answer.
So for me, I've been working on making algorithms that require you to be able to do operations on lots of systems at once, streaming, which means you can read each system in one at a time, and you need a smaller processor. So it's exciting to me because it's something we might be able to do in the near future, but also it taught us something about how you can think of a quantum machine learning about the input that's going into it. Because typically we think about learning about quantum systems in terms of making classical measurements on them, but our work was to try and get away from that paradigm as much as possible and keep everything quantum, everything coherent. So it's related to how a quantum machine learns about its quantum input, which is exciting to me.
Um,
understanding which abilities or skills you think someone who wants to do to become a physicist needs to improve or have.
To be a successful physicist, you need to be good at maths. You need to have good presentation skills. You need to. You need to have a certain amount of self-belief, and to be able to believe in that what you're doing is interesting, and to be able to sell that to other people, and to be able to take criticism on your work. So, I think I bring that one up a few times because that's the one that was hardest for me, to have a lot of confidence in yourself, and it's something that I hadn't thought about previously that would be something that would be important. And I think physics is more social than I expected, so interaction skills are very important.
Yeah.
Would you think to that
degree?
And perseverance. And
yep.
Just, you know, a thirst for knowledge, like being interested in understanding what.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
Kind
you
of
the
most important
thing.
The
most important
yeah.
thing is to have a passion.
Yeah, I don't have anything to add. Yeah.
Do you have some kind of certain goals in physics research?
Have any what?
Certain goals. Like
certain goals?
Yeah.
I mean, there are... I don't have an extremely long-term goal, but, of course, I have local... goals. I mean, I have projects I'm working on, I have things I'm trying to prove, I have kind of conjectures that I believe are true and I want to know about. So I think all physicists kind of in the back of their mind, they have this list of what they're kind of trying to do. Of course, that changes very rapidly sometimes, and maybe in the middle of one project you realize actually it would be really, really interesting to just do something that's completely different, it's not really that obvious when that kind of change occurs somehow. But so I would say most people would have an internal list of goals, but they're not like extremely long term goals usually.
Yeah, I would agree. I think you have goals in mind and they change all the time. So yeah, it's important to have them, to have some direction to your research, but it's also important to be able to go wherever it takes you, something interesting comes up to go on that tangent.
I mean, there's such a long list of problems that I would like to solve in my mind, and I have to somehow decide which one is the most interesting at any given time, and that can easily change a lot, and then I can add new problems to the list and solve. So it's a very complicated process, actually.
So if you had to do it all again, is there anything that you would do differently?
No. The courses I don't give an undergrad. But we said that already.
I mean, there's nothing strikingly obvious that I can say that I would like to change. Of course, there are little things which I could have done better. I should have perhaps been more proactive at trying to do networking when I was younger, and I should have gone to more conferences when I was a younger student, just to know people more. I mean, these things in hindsight would have helped, but they're kind of minor. They're minor kind of strategic things, I would say, rather than huge changes that I would highlight.
I have nothing.
So we have just a few minutes left. Maybe just one or two more questions, and then we will let the start of the lecture off the box.
A joint honors degree in physics and applied maths, And it's funny because so it could have been physics applied maths or physics and math, or single honors physics. And the people who did the single honors did a lot more maths than I did, because by taking the applied math, I missed out on all the math modules that they took. But again, it's not something I would change. I enjoyed that course. Maybe I would change it.
I mean, I think it depends a lot on the university and exactly how the course looks. So there's no real right answer to this. I would say if you really know already you want to be a theoretical physics, what a theoretical physicist, then I would read very carefully the description of the course, which typically you can find on the website of the university you're going to apply to. And you can kind of see how mathematical it is and how, I mean, of course, it's maybe difficult when you don't really know what these topics are, but I think probably you can still get a flavor of how mathematical and how theoretical it is and kind of judge that. But I would say as a physicist, you can't know too much mathematics.
But it depends on, as well, what kind of physics. I think for me, doing physics and applied maths was because I was more interested in the engineering side at the time. And I think as an experimental physicist, you need more applied skills and not as much of the abstract mathematics. So again, I would say take what interests you. If you really think you definitely want to be a theoretical physicist, then yes, do lots of math. If you think you might be more interested in more applied stuff, then maybe more applied maths or just physics is important.
Yes, I mean, as if you're an experimental physicist, I would say I would just do physics. I mean, I think there's no need really to. I think joint honours probably hurts you. I mean, my personal feeling is that most physics courses are designed to build experimental physicists. But maybe that's just a symptom of the course I did. And there's another thing to bear in mind, which is that some places, actually, if you study mathematics, that can actually kind of be a theoretical physics course in later years. So it's worth bearing that in mind. I mean, if you really know you want to be a theoretical physicist, it might actually be best to study only mathematics and just take all the theoretical physics options.
I think there's a
question. How much of a crossover is there between like chemistry or biology or other scientific fields?
There's a crossover. It depends on where in the field you lie. So biophysics is a big field, medical physics.
Physical chemistry, though.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, the subjects all come together at certain points, and it depends which area you're working to how close. I mean, personally, I don't ever really interact with anybody who's a biologist or a chemist.
In our field, you could get by without knowing any chemistry or biology. I guess there's some semiconductor physics in which chemistry might be important.
Certainly.
If you're interested in, say, biology and physics, then there are areas you can go into. If you want to avoid biology, that's also possible. So there's definitely some crossover.
Physics will change
next year. Well, you could ask that at any point in history, and the answer would always be, we hope there'll be a leap breakthrough. So I guess for our field, we'd really like to see a quantum computer. For more general modern physics, we'd really like to see a breakthrough in the theory of everything.
If we knew what how it would look in 10 years, we could work on all those issues. So it's difficult.
Yeah.
And we're trying to predict what the best thing will be in 10 years' time by working on it now, but of course we may be wrong.
So I think that's a really good question to leave it off on. So we're at 5 o'clock. You guys have really, really wonderful questions.